It's Wednesday, September 25th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. And today we talk of Nebraska State Senator Mike McDonnell. He was a Democrat. He became a Republican. For a second there, he had the potential to be one of the most pivotal figures in American politics. Because, you see, Nebraska is one of two states, Maine being the other, that doesn't give all of its electoral votes away to one candidate, like some slatternly geopolitical area. No, they carve out by congressional district votes. So whoever gets the most votes in the state gets most of the votes, but then each congressional district gets its own vote. So Maine 1, Nebraska 2 can be different from the bulk of Maine and the bulk of Nebraska. And after McDonnell left the Democratic Party to join the Republicans, and with the state Senate, which is to say the unicameral, they call them senators in Nebraska, but there's only one house in the state legislature, the unicameral. With that so close, there was the potential where he, to help the Republicans, could do away with the whole system. Now, Nebraskans love this system. Or actually, I should say, liberal Nebraskans, Democratic Nebraskans who live near Omaha love this system practically lately because it is a way to give Democrats an extra vote that Nebraska was not going to give them anyway. It's also been the case that Nebraska's second has gone for Republicans, meaning all the electoral votes have gone for Republicans. It's not been the case since this was in effect where the votes of all of Nebraska could have gone for Democrats, but for the second, which could have gone Republicans. But anyway, State Senator Mike McDonnell backed off the plan, probably because there was too much pressure nationally from guys like Lindsey Graham and other national political figures that makes the locals look like they're under the thumb of the big guys, in this case, Lindsey Graham being the big guy. But I love the quirky system of Maine and Nebraska, and I was asking myself why, and I think if I'm being honest with myself, it's just the quirkiness. I mean, you could make an argument that having these carve-outs lessens the deleterious effect of the Electoral College, but it also plays into the fact that we have an Electoral College. It makes the drawing of congressional districts all the more important, and that's probably not a good thing. Drawing congressional districts are a distinctly human endeavor, which means they're quite susceptible to venality, which is even more pertinent when it comes to the highest office in the land. At least the state can't be gerrymandered. Start carving out congressional districts that could go to one candidate in violation or in opposition to the rest of the state. That's probably not a good thing. And there's just a randomness to it. It's very odd and random to have a system of selecting the president that's as bizarre as ours. But then you also have these two carve-outs in very small states. I don't know that anyone would invent the system or argue that these small carve-outs are an improvement on a flawed system. But again, it's quirky. And I like quirky. Like in Major League Baseball, how the length of the outfield walls differs from stadium to stadium, park to park. Of course, umpire calls, they get them wrong sometimes, and people defend that as the quirkiness of baseball. But no, I just want balls to be called balls and strikes to be called strikes. So Nebraska perpetuates the system, keeps up the quirk, and I guess if we can't have efficacy, equity, fairness or logic, at least our electoral system, which does designate the most important person in the world, at least it can have a fair bit of quirk on the show today. Well, not just the show today. I will be joined by Steve Kornacki, and we will also have extra sports talk with Steve Kornacki. That is available for the Pesca Plus among you, Pesca Plus subscribers. Go to subscribe.mikepesca.com to get the show without ads or with a little extra, in this case, extra Steve Kornacki. And who doesn't like that? But this is not just any ordinary segment. We're debuting our electoral preview segments. We're going to give you some of the great prognosticators in the land, your Amy Walters, your Harry's Enten, your Steve's Kornacki. And if it is, therefore, a branded segment, I should give you a branded jingle. Here we go. We watch maps. We watch maps. We watch maps. You won't fall for bad polling traps. from Wisconsin to Pennsylvania. The expertise on offer can save ya. From Arizona to Nevada, whose polls may make you madder. Maine 1, Nebraska 2 is not a baseball score to you if you're like us. And watch the maps! Steve Kornacki is a national political correspondent for NBC. Of course, you know what he really does is he goes on MSNBC and NBC on election night, and he has a board and he wears tan pants and he tells you everything you need to know about the election. I also want to plug the fact that he produced one of the great political podcasts of the last 10 years, which is, say, the podcasting era, and was based on his book. The podcast was called The Revolution. It was based on his book, The Red and the Blue. And this is how I know it was good. The podcast was about 6 episodes and was mostly about Newt Gingrich. And it did not go easy on Newt Gingrich. It was, I think, very fair, but very critical of Newt Gingrich. And after the podcast aired, in which he asked Newt Gingrich for an interview and was denied, it was so good that Newt Gingrich called him up and said, all right, I'll do your interview now. Steve Kornacki, welcome back to The Gist, and congrats again on that big Newt Gingrich get.
No, Mike, thanks. Honestly, I love hearing that because I mean, I loved doing that podcast, and that interview with Newt was, it was truly interesting. So no, thank you.
And he wasn't denying your, this is not where we want to take this, but I got to ask, he wasn't really denying your premise. He, as I recall, grudgingly said you got it right, or was he correcting the record mode?
Yeah, and I didn't view my premise as you know, accusatory or necessarily even negative.
It paints him as like this extremely pivotal figure in American politics.
Right, and I think it just depends on your perspective. I mean, the premise I think that's shared is that he was a disruptor. He was the ultimate disruptor in Congress that set a lot of things in motion. And, you know, there's a view of that that was the ruination of everything. And there's a view of that it was necessary and that you know, he was somebody like him was long overdue. So I think we left room, I hope, for interpretation, and I think that's what he saw in it. But I don't want to put words in his mouth.
Now, disrupting the polling that we've been seeing lately is the New York Times Siena poll, and we'll get to that. But where, I don't know, how do you even answer this question? Where does the presidential race stand? Do you usually just say, here's what the average of the best polls are in the swing states? Is that the best way to answer the question?
I think so. I mean, I think it's to just, when in doubt, and frankly, I'm always in doubt these days, you put an average together and you see what that shows you. Now, there's some added twists to that. One is that we saw in 16 and in 20 polling misses, and they weren't evenly distributed polling misses, which is to say, like, it's not like they were off as much in Georgia and Arizona as they were in Wisconsin and Michigan. They were way off in Wisconsin and Michigan. They're pretty good in Arizona and Georgia. So we had a sort of a demographic and geographic specific polling miss in 16 and 20. There was an effort between 16 and 20 to account for it. It was basically had to do with these, you know, with the white voters without four-year degrees, big population in those northern states, heavily pro-Trump, just their Trump level of Trump support not fully accounted for in 16. The effort between 16 and 20 to account for it didn't really work. Now, has it been fixed between 20 and 24? It's just a huge variable every time we look at these polls.
Yeah. So I want to get to that in a second. But what do the average of the polls in the swing states, or maybe the average of the good polls, tell us?
They tell us that Harris is doing marginally better in those northern battlegrounds, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, than in the Sun Belt states, which would be North Carolina, Georgia, Arizona. And yeah, I put Nevada in there too. And Nevada, I put more in the category of just kind of total wild card. The polling there can be particularly erratic. But Arizona, Georgia, North Carolina, those Time Siena polls that came out this week put Trump ahead in all three of those. Whereas when you look at those, you know, there's a Wisconsin poll that just came out yesterday, same time, I think, as the New York Times Siena that had Harris up 6 right there. But again, like I said, Wisconsin was the biggest miss of 2020. So, you know, keep that in mind.
Right. So they try to correct it. I mean, they tried to correct it between 16 and 20. And it's not like they, well, I don't know, maybe it is they have some inroads to find those non-college educated whites, or is it mostly they say to themselves, polling being as much art and science, we know that we strongly think we're undercounting them, so we're going to overweight them in samples, and every non-college educated white counts as 1.2 voters in our sample. How do they do it, and how do we know they're getting it right?
Well, the you know, the problem with it is this, or at least the ultimate unknown of it is this. Trump runs up the score with non-college whites, white voters without four-year degrees. We know that. But, okay, so you can make sure you are getting in your poll a representative sample just based on the share of the electorate that non-college whites made up in the past and what you can reasonably expect them to make up in 2024. I think they can get that part right. The problem is this. When you're attaining that sample or weighting based on what you've got, there are still non-college whites who vote Democratic. And if there's an issue here, whether it's there's all sorts of possible explanations that have been offered about the pro-Trump side of that demographic. Some have said is that you're hostile to the media, hostile to pollsters, you know, it's terms like social trust that you hear. Is there something like that? Where so what you end up doing is you get quote unquote the right number of non-college whites, but disproportionately the non-college whites who are willing to sit through your 25-minute survey are the Democratic non-college whites. So you're still missing it that way. That possibility looms. You know, I saw an interview with a Siena pollster who was saying one thing they're doing this time around is, you know, in the past, they'd get Trump voters, maybe from that demographic, who would just sort of announce at the start of the call, I'm for Trump, I don't need to tell you anything else, and basically hang up. And that in the past, that's not a completed interview. Now, at least this one pollster was saying, it is. So maybe that, we'll you know.
So then, man, maybe this speaks to Nevada. Is there some reason or is it a fact that a non-college educated Latino will sit and answer, is more likely to answer a pollster's question than a non-college educated white?
In Nevada, I think there's just all sorts of issues with, I mean, one, you start getting into like, you know, polling in Spanish in some cases, you know, you have a lot of Spanish first folks. And, you know, you do have a bit of the split that you see non-college, college is much more pronounced with white voters than it is with Hispanic voters. But you are starting to see it to some degree, you know, with Hispanic voters, especially when you layer on, you know, gender on top of it. And you were to go from like, you know, male non-college educated Latino versus female college educated Latino, you will find, you know, a pretty sizable variance there. But it's nothing on the order of what you'd find among white voters. And so it used to be with white voters, they didn't really worry about the college, non-college distinction at all. I think that's what kind of got them in 16. It used to be, you got the right number of white voters, whatever, it works itself out.
Right. The demographics would be, here's who we polled, and they'd list the ethnic groups and then they'd list the genders.
Right.
And they wouldn't go deeper than that. But am I right? Like, will a pollster tell you that the non-college educated white is the most elusive even amongst Trump voters?
That's what they've said post-16 and post-20. Their solution for it post-16 was this idea of weighting by education. So now you're making sure not just that the poll is, you know, representative of the, you know, share of the white vote, but specifically right. The white college, white non-college share. So that was the solution to get. But again, it didn't work. So I know it's been a particular concern, you know, but there are other, you know, issues too that are always coming up, you know. And again, I mentioned one of them there just with you know, Hispanic voters, you know, I think are a particular challenge, you know, for all sorts of reasons. And frankly, when you look inside the polling, a lot of these, you know, national polls right now, when you're trying to get a read on like the Hispanic vote or even the black vote for that matter, you're talking about groups, you know, Hispanics are 13% of the electorate, you know, African-Americans about 10% of the electorate nationally. So in the context of a normal poll where you're, you know, maybe contacting 1,000 people, 1,200 people, something like that, you're already getting the number, you know, a total number of Latinos surveyed, African-American surveyed is low enough that it can bounce around a lot. And so few and far between are the polls that just specifically try to get a big sample, 1,000+ of Latino voters or black voters. But you look for, from my standpoint, at least you look to those because that's, you know, those are going to be, I think, better barometers.
Right. Let's go through the states and you tell me if there's a strong indication, and by strong, I might mean 5 percentage points of who's leading, or if the election were held today and the polls were totally accurate. So there are 7 states and then 2 congressional districts that might matter a little bit. Pennsylvania.
I mean, if the polls are just accurate today, Harris, it's slight, but Harris has the lead in the average.
Wisconsin.
That would be her strongest state right now.
Mm-hmm. Michigan.
And that would also, she'd be ahead in the average. Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, in that order.
Okay, if we give them to her, has she won 270 yet?
as long as she holds on to the second congressional district of Nebraska, where they do that individual, that would give her 270, which I think might have been the reason, you know, if you saw this new push that appears to have fizzled by Lindsey Graham and the Trump campaign to get Nebraska to change that law. I'm wondering if it's a recognition of, you know, they sense there might be, you know they need to get one of those three, you know, northern states, and they might be saying, boy, this might be a little tougher than we thought. Can we get this Nebraska thing and change it? It doesn't look like they're going to, though.
Right. I want to ask you about that, by the way, because I'm talking about that, or I've talked about that. Is there, I know you're a descriptive guy and not a normative guy, you try not to be, but give me the good, not the fun, because we like electoral fun, but what are the good reasons for Maine and Nebraska to have these carve-outs other than they can in the Constitution?
I think one reason would be an attempt to make the state more relevant to in a presidential campaign.
Right. No, that is true for their own interest, but then every other state is irrelevant? That doesn't seem fair.
Well, it's up to the states. I mean, they could all do it, you know, if they wanted to. And at various times, there's been pushes from different parties to try to do that, you know, in some of these states. I remember post-2012, some Republican legislatures in, you know, I think it was Pennsylvania, Michigan, states like this, you know, were they wanted to do it because, you know, they Romney had come so close and got zero out of those states. So,
and what's so hard about that is the impetus is there after your state loses, which is to say you don't have a majority of voters who are in favor of that kind of change, because if you did, they would have voted for that presidential candidate, i.e. Romney in Pennsylvania anyway.
Yeah. And I mean, usually that's where these reforms on this scale break down, is that usually you need to have some semblance of buy-in from both parties. And we're in this era now where every one of these potential changes is each party making this absolute immediate bottom line calculation of, does it possibly disadvantage me? And, you know, the Nebraska and Maine things were done 30 plus years ago. I think 1991 is when they made the changes there. And just it was a different, you know, different universe.
One of the arguments to keep it, to keep these little carve outs, the Obamaha carve out. And I don't know if Maine one has a cute little nickname like that, but the candidates will go to the districts to campaign there, thus helping the local economy. How strong is that true? How strong an argument do you think that is?
Probably not that strong, but there's probably, you know, some truth to it. I mean, the TV stations in Maine, well, they would get a little bit of advertising in the past in Portland because it bleeds over into New Hampshire, and New Hampshire's, you know, often been a swing state. But yeah, I think Maine would get a lot more, relatively speaking, you know, spent on it. The Omaha airwaves, I think, you know, you know, as well.
Yeah, but you're throwing out half your money on Council Bluffs there anyway.
Yeah, well.
Maybe a third.
Although I was, not anymore really, but I was in a swing state before. So.
I was in Maine when Susan Collins eked out that surprise victory in 2020. And it did underline to me something that Mike Murphy just said on the Hacks on Tap podcast about the amount of television advertising there is. What's better, dropping one piano on people's heads or two pianos? Like, at this point, I do not think that television advertising for the president is moving anyone's needle. Maybe for lower races, certainly for lower races, not TV advertising for the presidency.
Yeah, no, I tend to, you're in this, you know, era too, where it's like, you know, who's watching? Who's actually watching the television anymore versus...
You would think it was non-college educated whites.
You know, older, which certainly, I think it would skew older too, you know, definitely. But there's certainly a point of diminishing returns there. But what else are they going to do?
That's right. Now, let's go through some of the other states because we stopped. Arizona right now, if the polls are accurate and the vote was held today.
With this new New York Times one plugged in, which was, I think, a 5-point advantage for Trump, I think Trump now narrowly would have the advantage there. But I mean, again, we're talking fractions of a point here.
How big an outlier was the Times one? It was the seeing before.
Yeah, well, it was a huge shift from the last New York Times poll of Arizona. You know, it was basically, right, I think, a net 10-point shift right there.
And that's important because different polls will say different things. But do you, as a professional, you know, one of the professionals in the field, do you give extra credence to how much each poll internally has changed since it's the same methodology from poll to poll?
I think it was, I think it was Nate Silver who said this, which if not him, somebody else, and I want to give them credit. And it was just that the idea that when a pollster, when you see that from a pollster, it probably speaks well of the pollster, because I think it shows they're confident enough in their methodology and their approach that they're willing to, you know, live with results that are, you know, people are going to question and going to challenge, and they're not going to try to cover them up, hide them, cancel the poll, get wishy-washy about it. And there's sort of a confidence there, I think, and a professionalism that it probably speaks well over all the poll.
Or the Dunning-Kruger effect writ large, right? Like, you don't know, the most ignorant people are the most confident. I wouldn't say that about the Times-Siena poll, but just wild swings could mean, wow, I really respect that, or wow,
well, yeah,
you did not earn that respect.
But Nate Cohn does the, you know, sort of heads up the New York Times polls. And I would, you know, if you read his stuff, it's some of the most nuanced stuff you'll read.
Yeah.
You know, so he's definitely not, he's allowing for all sorts of, you know, random sampling error and noise and all of these things. And he's telling people, I think, to a degree, to take it with a grain of salt.
Yeah, he is one of the top two Nates in the field. that's Arizona. Where's Nevada right now if we're held today?
If the average is in Harris's favor there, again, I think that's just the one where you've seen, I think the polling has been sort of the most wild there. If you were to zoom out, you know, a year, 6 months or something, and sort of has that reputation of being a bit of a wild card polling wise.
Let's go with Georgia and North Carolina. Same questions with them.
Trump's best state in the polling is Georgia, mm-hmm. and North Carolina, it's going to depend on the average that you look at. It's going to be a fraction of a point, you know, in either direction.
Wow.
You know, 0.3 for Trump, 0.2 for Harris, you know, something along those lines.
Any chance that an already trailing candidate in Mark Robinson, let's say the bottom falls out and he loses by 20. So I've heard different phrases for that, like reverse coattails, or I don't know what the coattails versions of headwinds would be, but that usually doesn't happen, that a lower ballot race affects the upper ballot. But could it, even to a fraction of a point?
Yeah, I mean, look, when you're talking about two extremes here. See, in that sense, you can't rule it out. The extreme example with Mark Robinson and the potential he has for the floor to fall out here, an extreme example in terms of what you're looking for in terms of an effect, like a fraction of a point. So
I see.
When you're at that level,
we can't generalize about. Let's stupidly call it reverse coattails. Yeah. I got to come up with something better than that. You know, lapel tails. Right. With just a fallout or a cratering of one candidate might not be that big a deal. With just a tiny margin might not be that big a deal. Add them both together could be a huge deal or
and
a
that,
big deal.
It is big. And then, though, that puts it in a category with a lot of other things, because when you're in that realm and you're talking about could this thing sway a couple thousand votes, potentially that being the difference. Tons of things start entering into that. So I would kind of put it in that realm. I don't think big picture, if you're talking about 5 points, 3 points, something like this. And I don't think so. But again, you're at a real micro realm there, you know, and it's in some ways it's probably unprovable ultimately. But I think there's a lot of things that could do that.
And we'll be back in a second with more Kornacki. Get ready for the Kornacki attack. Part two. This guy's good. We're back with Steve Kornacki, who is the electoral guru for NBC, and we shall continue talking about the state of play of this year's presidential race. I was talking to not a pollster, but someone who pretty much covers polls for a living, and he made an interesting point, which is that everyone is predicting that election night will be close. And I know for your corporate bosses, they probably want that. But he says, if we just have the same polling error that we had in 2020 or 2016, and they were in different directions, and you could talk about that, it won't be close. Because either, if the polling error is in Donald Trump's favor, it will be, since he has such an electoral college advantage, it'll be obvious that he's won. And if it's in Harris's advantage, since she's already polling ahead, it will be pretty obvious that she's won. What do you think of that theory?
Well, there's a logistical aspect of it, which is just the speed of any of this becoming apparent based on vote counting procedures is, you know, so you're going to get, for instance, Arizona, you're going to get like 65% of their vote very quickly. And then you're going to get the remaining 35% very slowly. And the final, you know, I don't know, 20% or so extremely slowly. Like I'm talking, a week. Right. Nevada can be very similar to that. Just there's quirks in how they do things that keep it slow. So if it's at all close in those states, you know, you're talking about, you're not really going to know for a bit.
Do those states count the mail-ins as they come in, or they start counting them a week beforehand, or do they wait for the mail-ins?
Well, so what happens is a lot of people take in their mail ballots on election day, and they're allowed to drop them off anywhere. They don't have to go to like an assigned precinct. And so what happens is that creates this, there's this huge pile of return, people personally returning mail-in ballots that then have to be processed and routed to the correct places. Then right. The normal process of validating the vote and all that. So it just creates this huge logjam. And then every night, you know, around, I think it's like 9 p.m. Eastern, you're going to get this for the whole week. You're just going to get like Maricopa County, which is almost 2/3 of Arizona. That's, if it's close, that's going to be the thing. Every 9 o'clock, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday night, here's the big batch from Maricopa. And as the batches, they work their way closer and closer to the election day vote. They don't even get, I think in Arizona, they have the mail through like maybe the Thursday before the election counted. Or ready to go on election night. And then everything else is slow. Like Nevada.
I remember that from 2020. It was like set your advent calendar.
And Pennsylvania, you know, they can't really begin processing these things till, the morning of the election. And that's what you ran into in 2020. And I'm not sure, it's the mail-in ballots is what I'm talking about here. And I'm not sure, you know, there probably won't be as much mail, so we're not in the middle of the pandemic. But you remember how that one went, you know, Trump dominates in the same day vote, and then the Democrats make up for it in the mail-in vote. And that took a while to kind of come into focus in Pennsylvania, too. And that could happen again as well.
Is there every indication that it will play out in that regard, that the mail-in vote will skew much more Democrat?
Yeah, I mean, it was.
Has it been in the election? Was that the case in 2022 in the places that we saw mail-in vote be a big factor?
Yeah, Pennsylvania in 2020, the mail-in vote, I think, was like 76-23 for the Democrats. It was something like that. And now Republicans and the Trump folks have tried to make an effort to you know, make a dent in that this time. And I suspect they will. But a dent is not going to even it out completely. I think there's a lot of within the last few years, and certainly post 2020, I think there's a lot of kind of partisanship around mail-in voting that's in most states that's been kind of built.
Yeah,
in. You don't see it as much like in a Florida or something.
Yeah, there is partisanship, and a lot of it was the denigration of the mail-in system as a tactic and a campaign point by Trump in 2020. And as you say, you know, that wasn't to his advantage, and so they tried to. It's just logically, every candidate would like their voters to have every opportunity to vote for them in any way that's easiest. So other than that, are there naturally occurring reasons in terms of how the parties are aligned that a typical Republican is just more likely to go to the polls on election day and a typical Democrat would be much more open to mailing? Or is this just how they've been taught because of 2020 and the strategy therein?
I think it's mostly, you know, a product of 2020. It's a product of all of the rhetoric that's kind of built up around, you know, Republicans will frame it as election integrity, and that will be associated with you go and you vote in person and you bring an ID with you, this sort of thing. So I think a lot of it has to do with that. Because again, you'll look at like Florida, that'll come in, we'll get the Florida will be the clearest big state the earliest. And what'll happen there is you'll get in every county within an hour of the polls closing, which is generally going to be 7 o'clock Eastern in the state, except the panhandle. You're going to get 2/3 of the vote within the first 30 minutes, I should say. And that 2/3 is going to be basically all of the mail and all of the early voting that was done. And it's going to be a little bit more Democratic than the same day, but nothing on the order of what you're talking about in a Pennsylvania or something. It's probably in any given county. You know, the Democrats are probably going to do 4 or 5. They're probably going to fall about 4 or 5 points from that first readout of that two-thirds of the vote. So in a state like Florida, where this goes back two decades in Florida, what they're kind of the way they run things now. So a lot of those habits, I think, were set in place pre, you know, 2020. And that shows you
a realistic kind of... butterfly ballot. There was a huge overhaul and they got things good. All we need is a major society-defining foul-up and maybe things will get better.
Well, I tell people this all the time. Is I try to, you know, please take the partisanship away for 1 second and just like take a look. Florida was the scene of electoral chaos, obviously, in 2000, and this, you know, bungled, mismanaged, you know, all the stuff you're citing there. It's so smooth now in how they do this. They can get, you know, this massive state, they can get basically fully reported out on election night by about 11 o'clock. There are ways, and that is allowing for a lot of early voting and a lot of mail-in voting. And one of the key differences is simply what we were talking about with Arizona and Nevada earlier, you know, which is to say, if you did not do your mail-in ballot, you know, prior to election day, you're going to your precinct on election day, and it just speeds up the administrative process. Just that change, that difference.
And also, in terms of put the partisanship aside, if there is an argument that slow voting is somehow fits in with voter suppression, which is what Democrats consistently accuse Republicans of. You have Florida, which I think that there is one Democrat elected statewide. It's lately been a very Republican-dominated state, is the apotheosis of functionality in terms of electoral turns. And then look at California and New York. How do those states do, Steve?
Oh, California's... It's election month in California, and where that comes into...
And I bring those up because, of course, they're Democratic dominated.
Right.
States.
Except, well, California, though, we expect the House is going to be very close here, and there's a handful of very competitive House races in California, and so we may be waiting on House control for a long time, you know, in California. In 2022, obviously it was very close, we called the 218th seat in 2022 for Republicans. I think it was... a week, I think it was 8 days. 8 days after the election, we called it, and it was the 27th district of California. It was Mike Garcia. This is the outskirts of LA County. It was 8 days later, and there were still uncalled races. One up in the you know, Sierras, and just extremely, extremely slow there. And it's in the presidential race. It's only consequential from the standpoint of, if you're trying to gauge the national popular vote, the Democrats just rolling up such massive margins. They will, over the course of that month of November, pad, you know, like a million votes or something out of California that you didn't have on election night. So there's that. But battle for the House, California could keep us waiting this time around.
Right. And, you know, it's funny. The House gets sworn in before the president does. So there's an argument that timeliness is more important. Just seems the stakes are lower. And, of course, there hasn't been any violence about the House elections that are contested. So I do want to ask you this one last political question. And then I'm going to bend your ear on a sports question or two, if that's fine, because I know that you are an underutilized expert. What could change without a debate? You know, crazy things can happen. But from your experience doing this, we're at the point that we're at, which is where almost in October, and there are October surprises, but what generally and how much does sentiment change, and what changes it in political presidential races that are close?
You're asking about what, you know, used to be called the October surprise.
There could be an October surprise, or maybe the answer is, you know, in most of the races you look at, it was either a 1% lead one way, or that's what we thought it was, and then it wound up being a 1% lead the other way, or something like that. So what is the usual way that things swing back and forth, or what are some of the ways?
Well, I mean, there's to this day, there's a debate. You know, I think, you know, 2016 is a great example. I mean, just, you know, Hillary Clinton obviously led the polls, you know, all the way, you know, the whole story. And there's a very common explanation is the Comey letter. You know, saying, mm-hmm. Oh, we've found some more, we're going to reopen this investigate, you know, and then a week later, you know, but so there's a version of it where that was it, that like there were these kind of, these folks had, you know, sort of come around to voting for Clinton and had reservations. And then suddenly this like brought back all of their reservations and, you know, added punch to things Trump had been saying. Okay, there's that version of it. There's another version that I'm, again, all untestable, but I kind of feel like, you know, with or without the Comey letter, there were these deep, deep reservations people had about Hillary Clinton that were just so obvious in the polling, you know, throughout that campaign and for decades earlier, you know, for that matter. And was there a voter there that was like, you know, Trump was just, you know, the whole campaign, they weren't going to say they were voting for Trump. They understood, you know, that there were things about him that they were, this is not really who I'd want or anything like that. But they were never really going to vote for Clinton. And it was just when it finally came down to it, that's what happened. And they just, you know, and I mean, a formative thing, you know, for me, I mean, this is going back 30 years, but I, you know, it's a famous one. I covered New Jersey politics for a while, governor's race in New Jersey, where the Democrat led, you know, in the polls, Jim Florio, incumbent governor, he'd been very unpopular, had raised taxes, all this stuff. And he led Christine Todd Whitman throughout the 93 election, looked like he was going to pull out this against the odds win, but he was always at like 46, 47% in the polls. And there was just this voter out there that in the end, they were never going to vote for Florio. And they weren't saying during the campaign they were voting for Whitman, but then on election day, Florio was still at 46, 47% and just got caught. And that one just always stuck out in my mind.
Was the polling then, did it show up with deep, deep reservations about Florio like it did with Clinton?
Yeah.
But is Kamala Harris, I know voters say, they're still saying I don't know her as much, and she's losing on the big issues like immigration and the economy. But are those deep reserves of reservations or those deep pockets of disquiet being picked up in polls?
So in our poll that came out this week, we have her at 48% positive, 45% negative. By contrast,
in American politics, that's great.
It is the, you know, Trump we have at 40 to 53. Yeah. Biden, you know, we have at 41, 49. Now there's CNN. There's a CNN poll out today that doesn't have her doing, you know, quite as well. Doesn't have that quite same gap in their poll. You know, our poll had Harris up 5 nationally. The CNN poll has her up 1 nationally. So there's flux there. But on favorability, you know, personal image, something like that, I think across the board, she's done better in these polls than Biden had been. The doubts about Biden's, you know, age, mental fitness for the office, that's totally obviously just gone away. I mean, in our poll on that question, I think it's like a 70-point shift since Harris, you know, got in. You know, she does well on, you know, an area where Biden had really been struggling. Does the person have the competence to be president? She does well there now. Although that's one where Hillary Clinton had a massive advantage over Trump as well. And you saw what that ended up adding up to.
Right.
You know, so it's look, she's not running with quite the negatives that Hillary had. I think that's what it adds up to. But the exact degree of it is unclear.
Right. So, okay. So maybe this indicates that the kind of person who won't tell a pollster this, but just will never vote for Kamala Harris, they're out there. There's 330 million Americans, 150, 170 million will vote. There's some of those, but that it's not nearly as much as during Hillary. And even absent the Comey letter, those Hillary doubts showed, and it doesn't seem like Kamala Harris is courting that kind of broad doubt.
So does it exist at another level? Does it exist about the Democratic Party? Mm-hmm. I think that becomes the question too, a voter who's like, I don't want these Democrats, you know, that kind of thing.
Right. The other thing is I hear that in a close election, undecideds usually break against the incumbent. And I don't know how true that is, but that is what you ask political consultants. They will say it is a truism, let's say. And you've heard this, right?
Mm-hmm. The problem here, though, is who's treated as the incumbent?
You know? My exact question.
Right. Yeah.
What does that mean?
Right.
That's right. Who's the incumbent? Yeah.
And
I don't know how true it is anyway.
Yeah. I mean, our poll, we asked the question, who better represents change? Maybe that's a way of getting at that. Our poll came back 47-38 Harris, you know, on that question. But then we also had a poll question too about concerns about her attachment.
I gotta say, and you're good at this, I don't love that question as a proxy for who's the incumbent. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously Kamala Harris as a Black Indian American woman who's not Donald Trump is more change than he is. That mm-hmm. doesn't mean she's not that doesn't mean that she's not the incumbent. I mean, she is the vice president, and he was only president 2 terms ago.
Yeah, no, and I mean, there were a couple of, we asked the question too about, you know, does the type of change, some version of, you know, does the type of change the candidate represents concern you? And it was basically a wash, but there was a little bit more concern when it came to Harris than to Trump on that. And then, yes, when we asked about concerns about being associated with, connected to the Biden administration, that registered, you know, that registered as well. And I think clearly, just when you look at in our poll, it was 9 points. It was 9 points in our poll. I think CNN, it was double digits today. Advantage on the economy for Trump, I think that connects certainly to her being in this administration.
Steve Kornacki is a national political correspondent for NBC News. He apparently knows something about polling. He also knows something about sports, which I'll talk to him for a minute on our Pesca Plus version of this. Thanks, Steve.
Hey, Mike. Thanks. This was fun.
That's it for today's show. The show is produced by the Quaint Mallards. Corey Warr is the producer and Joel Patterson's the senior producer. Michelle Pesca spearheads special projects for us at Peachfish. To advertise, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Mpuru, Jipuru, Dupuru, and thanks for listening.